current state, Mid-Michigan's destination for the informed, the caring, and the curious for Monday, July 14th. The World Cup is history, Common Ground is history, and here on Bastille Day, on Current State, meet the owners and operators of Lansing's first distillery. It is supposedly Lansing's first distillery in history. American Fifth Spirits is setting up shop right across the street from Cooley Law School Stadium, and we'll be meeting several of the guys who are behind this effort, and they are into it like nobody's business. We're going to be previewing what's going on tomorrow night in Minneapolis for the All-Star Game as well with WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports here on WKAR, and Current State's Peter Wharf coming up. Amongst other things here planned for this hour, we're glad you could join us. Twice in the past month, auditors have found serious problems at Michigan Human Services agencies. Last week, a report from the state auditor's office found the Michigan Department of Human Services has failed to investigate cases of suspected adult abuse and to adequately train its staff. Last month, it claimed it found millions of dollars in improper expenditures in a program for vulnerable, low-income adults. It said a number of those served by home health care workers were being attended to by ex-offenders who had been convicted of crimes, some of them serious, up to murder. To learn more about these audits and what they all mean, we welcome back to the Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer, who continues to cover both of these stories. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Two audits in consecutive months, both of them quite critical. Tell us more about what last week's audit showed.
Well, I mean, we're talking about, again, with both of these programs that are supposed to protect some of Michigan's most vulnerable citizens, adults, and it's you know, something that the administration is taking very seriously because, you know, in this case, we're talking about adult protective services, which, you know, when you think of DHS, a lot of the times you think of child protective services.
Sure.
But there are plenty of people who are adults, whether they're disabled or elderly, that are in states where they need certain protection, and DHS handles that. And in this case, basically the audit found that, the department was not going back and checking some of the closed cases to make sure that these problems hadn't popped up for certain people, that there were complaints of abuse or neglect that weren't being investigated, that weren't being followed up on. And it was very troubling for a lot of people who say, you know, this is one of those a very basic function of government. You know, you think of education, you think of infrastructure and protecting the most vulnerable citizens. And so it's something that's raised a lot of concerns.
Did the report cite specific examples of a request denial or failing to investigate?
It did outline a number of specific cases of people who, that said that they were that claimed that either they or someone that they knew were being neglected or abused that just weren't followed up on. Yeah, these audits are very in depth. This was conducted over a period of time. It looked at between 2010 and 11. To 2012 and 13. So this is something that it's not just that's been happening for a short period of time. This is something that's been going on for years over the course of two different administrations. It seems like these are systematic problems.
This is a historic. This is a problem with a historic dimension to it here in
yes.
Michigan. Regrettably, did both audits focus on the adult population?
Yes.
Okay. And for context, how many of these kinds of referrals does DHS get in, say, a year?
My understanding is that APS, Adult Protective Services, got more than 80,000 referrals of abuse, neglect, or exploitation, during the period of this audit. So
that's multiple years.
Yes, that is multiple years.
Just to be clear.
And it's hard to tell, and this is an important distinction here, that during that time, DHS saw more than a 60% increase in these referrals and reports. And part of that was because they made it easier for people to make these referrals and say that that they knew someone or they themselves were in a bad situation and that they wanted DHS to follow up. And so that's a very large increase of caseloads. The thing that's interesting to me is I spoke with Director Maura Corrigan of DHS about this, and I brought up that large increase of 60%. And for me, in my opinion, it would follow logically that with such a large increase in the number of cases that there would be growing pains, that it would be difficult to staff that, that maybe that was an explanation for some of – at least some of the instances of not following up. Director Corrigan did not give that as an explanation. She is owning this as something, you know, she says that we should have been able to handle this. And I think that that sort of speaks to a larger trend in this administration. Governor Rick Snyder's administration is a do more with less administration. Mm-hmm. And Maura Corrigan is definitely a subscriber to that. And so they're not saying that because of this increase or for any other reasons that this is an excuse for that. We, you know, we should have been able to handle this.
But a lot of this gets back. It isn't necessarily an increase in the instances of necessarily. It's most likely better reporting.
That's what Director Corrigan said. That okay. It's basically we've done a better job of making it easier for people to report these things. It's not necessarily that the state is seeing a big increase in abuse or neglect necessarily.
The spike is more noticeably in reporting.
Correct.
We're talking with Jake Neer, the Michigan Public Radio Network, about the two audits that found really serious problems here in Michigan's Human Service Agencies, DHS, and Department of Community Health as well. In let's go back to the mid-June audit now, a report you described in one of your stories, again involving DHS. This involves a failure to monitor home health care workers. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, the Michigan takes in federal dollars through Medicaid to help people who want to stay in their homes but who need in-home care. And again, we're talking about very vulnerable adults. And it is important also to say that these two programs, APS and the home health program, do not overlap. We're not talking about the same. These are two different distinct populations of vulnerable adults. And this report last month that you brought up, it involves both the Department of Human Services and DCH, the Department of Community Health. And basically it found that people are who have been convicted of felonies, even like Medicaid fraud specifically, or elder abuse or neglect, things that directly influence or would impact their qualifications as an in-home care provider, were allowed to work in the system and were allowed to care for some of these vulnerable adults. And it wasn't just a few cases. We're talking thousands of cases where this was an issue. And also that the department, DCH and DHS, I should say, misspent money shouldn't have. And these are federal dollars that the state may have to pay back or should have to pay back because it mismanaged the program.
And as unacceptable as that sounds, the serious offenders are sometimes caring for family members. That's really what people need to remember.
That's
here.
True. And it's not that, we were taking felons who had no connection with these people and just putting them in their homes. That's not necessarily the case. A lot of these people are sons, daughters, brothers, that sort of brothers, sisters, that sort of thing that are caring for people in their family. But still, it's the state does not think that it's acceptable that they allowed some of these, especially people who are convicted of abuse and neglect already, to go into homes and say, and work in those cases.
Mm-hmm. And the audits included some number of recommendations. What were some of those?
One thing is to do a better job collecting information in a timely manner, just basically to do the job of making sure that their records are up to snuff. Another important one, especially in the home health program that we were just talking about, is do background checks. The state does not have at this point background checks for in-home care workers. And that's something that DCH Director Jim Haveman says is coming in October. Because of this audit, they are putting in a background check system. Another thing is to put in controls to make sure that departments don't make improper payments and actually recover those improper payments. And then also just to do a better job keeping an eye on themselves, these departments, go back and revisit cases, make sure that these issues don't pop up again after the cases are closed.
So both of the agency directors involved here, Maura Corrigan at DHS and James Haveman at DCH, have both weighed in here and responded to both of these.
That's true, especially with that background check piece. Basically, the details on that are, again, these issues with elder abuse and neglect, Medicaid fraud. People who are convicted of those crimes will no longer be able to work in the Medicaid home health program because those convictions are so directly related to their duties in the program. It should be noted that people who are convicted of things like violent crimes, like assault, battery, even murder, second degree murder, manslaughter, will still be allowed to work in the program even though they're convicted of some of these violent crimes. That's because federal law says that you cannot exclude them from the program, but they will still be checked out so that patients will know that they're convicted of these things and can decide whether or not they want them in their home.
So, and that's viewed as a way back into society for some of these ex-offenders.
Sure, absolutely.
I have to ask this: are the agencies reopening or reinvestigating some of the actual cases cited in the audit?
Well, actually, DCH is saying that they've actually already, before the audit even came back, started recovering some of the money that they say that was misspent, and they went back and they have reopened some of these cases, saying that, you know, well, here's some instances where we did a poor job. And so, yes, they are going back and they're looking through their records. They're looking at some of the issues that were brought up in the audit and specifically individual cases, seeing what happened there.
Most of the legislature is away from the Capitol most of the time, as you're well aware, Jake.
Sure.
Has anyone commented?
Well, we did get a statement from a Representative Peter McGregor of Cannon Township. He is the House DHS, Department of Human Services, Appropriations Subcommittee Chair. And basically what that all means is he's the one in the House that sort of looks specifically at the DHS budget and sort of crafts the money that should be going to DHS in the House. And he said that, of course, that the findings in the Auditor General's reports are troubling and they expose failures in the DHS department and APS, the Adult Protective Services. He says that he and Speaker Bolger have actually sat down with Director Maura Corrigan and discussed these. He says that it seems like she has a good response in place, that he has faith in her to address this and faith in the department to address this, and basically that the audits did their job. They served their function of looking, taking a hard look at these departments and making sure that the imperfections the failures of the department are exposed and that they know what's going on and how to address those issues.
And our guest will continue to keep an eye on it. Jake Neer reports for the Michigan Public Radio Network. We've been talking about the two state auditors' critical audits of human services agencies here just in the past month in Michigan. Jake, many thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us here on Monday, July 14th. Lansing is about to get its first distillery. Well, its first legal distillery, anyway. American Fifth Spirits is coming to the city's Stadium District. American Fifth will make a variety of spirits, from vodka to gin to liqueurs. It's a project 5 years in the making, or in the words of one of our next guests, from idea to madness. And here to tell us more about American Fifth Spirits and what it hopes to offer, President and Head Distiller Rick Weibel. Rick,
good morning.
Welcome. And also Mike Bird, the distillery's Marketing Director. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Mike.
How you doing? So tell us when this dream took off and where you are today.
Well, like you said, it's been 5 years since I put this idea together. Back in 2009, funding was short to come by.
Hard time
point.
To look search for funding. Oh, nine.
Yes.
Not a real good year.
Not a real good year. And honestly, the industry was in its infancy at that point, so there wasn't a lot of history to draw on. So over the past 5 years, the industry has really taken off, and it was easier to find people who wanted to support it, both financially and obviously consumers that we're looking for.
Okay. Mike, why'd you take this on? What's the passion here for this?
Because I can handle the madness, I guess, once you get into that realm. I enjoy the process of it. It's a Michigan-based product. Everything we do starts from Michigan, from our grain to where we have it made to where we're going to sell it to what we want to scream. So I wanted to be on board, just on board with something like that. But it's so new and fresh that nobody else has done it.
Really,
it's such a trailblazing.
Yeah. What qualifies as a micro distillery exactly, Rick?
Well, that falls under what the state licensing is. So as long as we don't produce more than 60,000 gallons of hooch a year, we're micro.
Okay. So you are going in the hooch direction here, basically.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, tell us more about the various alcoholic beverages. What are you going to offer, Mike?
Well, we'll start off with vodka. We're going to call it Hue Vodka. That'll be released here in a few weeks. The next step that we have will be a gin product that we're going to make called Capital Gin. And then as the tasting room itself gets open, we're going to move into white whiskey, more traditionally known as hooch or moonshine. And that'll be an in-house product that we're going to kind of move towards. And that's going to be our natural flow in the beginning while we're getting set up those first three drinks.
Now, are you still refining the distillery process for any of these, or it sounds like you're about ready to move on the vodka?
Yeah, the vodka is done. We're just waiting for the government to approve the label so we can slap a label on there and sell it.
Okay.
So that will be distributed throughout the state. The Capital Gin will be distributed throughout the state. And then we'll do multiple things that will be available just in the tasting room. So that's part of the whole licensing process, is we can sell out of our tasting room as well. So we can make cocktails out of anything that we produce there, mm-hmm. and then people can buy a bottle and take it home with them.
Rick, how did you get into this madness?
I've actually been in the beer and wine wholesale business for the past 10 years. So over the course of that, I've seen Michigan wines take off, Michigan beer take off. And then really the only other segment of that was spirits. So when the state reduced their license fee from $10,000 down to $100,000, that's sort of what is the catalyst for the
sounds
the
like
boom.
An incentive.
Exactly.
And are you saying that all of the ingredients that you will need to make all of these alcoholic beverages are grown here in Michigan?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't have to import anything to create vodka, gin, or like light whiskey?
Well, there's some stuff that we would like to get exotic, but as far as our mainstays, we have basically the best agriculture you can get for grain in the country.
Well, yeah.
So
yeah.
Why not draw from the motherland, so to speak, right here? That's part of the reason why we wanted to do it. We've got the best grains available right in our backyard. Why not go ahead and run through the best process available and make them taste the best,
Yeah, we've gone through or gone around and spoken with a lot of farmers, local farmers, and there's a reason, as we found out, that the top four cereal producers are based in Michigan, and it's all about the grain here. The quality of grain is superb.
Rick Weibel and Mike Bird are our guests here on Current State. They are the president and head distiller of American Fifth Spirits, and Mike Bird is the distillery's marketing director. Is this truly Lansing's first distillery ever?
Based on the research I have done, which it accounts for tax records. So the government tracks all that stuff. And apparently, there's never been any taxes paid out of Lansing from a distillery prior to this point.
So Jedediah Primrose in 1843 didn't have a distillery at what is now the intersection of the...
I was wondering if we were going to get a Jedediah reference today. It finally got pulled out, so thank you, Mark.
Well, in the 19th century, I mean, anybody who knows much about American history knows, I mean, alcohol was big business in the 19th century.
Well, yeah. Across the country, again, according to my research, there were over 3,000 distilleries. And then Prohibition hit, and obviously it slowed everything down. Mm.
Did you guys visit similar operations before you launched this, Mike?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How many? Did you travel the country?
Well,
or
I actually lived outside of Michigan for the last 15 years between Vegas, Houston, and Phoenix. I was born and bred here, went to Michigan State, graduated in 2000. So, you know, in my research, I've been to several places that are distilleries and serve distilled products, and I've seen lots of them, yes. But the mainstay about it, every one of them has a story. It's the story of what they're doing and why they're doing it, and that's what made them all unique. Like, you know, you've got your Tito's, you know, why they're doing what they do. Even if you get into, like, your breweries, they have these stories. Well, it's an awesome story. So I got involved because I want to tell the story of how it works because it doesn't need to be secretive.
Okay.
It's just – it's a fun process to go and talk to the locals to get our stuff, work with local products while we're here, sell it locally, and get it big from locally from here. It's just, I mean, it's just a fun story. I mean, what other business do you have that opportunity to really start as the baby and go all the way through the process and then go show it off and make money for it?
And you're creating a retail space, for lack of a better word, social space where people can come and sample what you're doing. Tell us where that is.
That is on Larch Street, down across from the Lugnut Stadium, just north of Michigan Avenue. I mean, we're spitting distance. If you walk out of Lugnuts and turn left, you're going to run into our building. So the goal is to have the tasting room, and it truly is a tasting room experience. We're not a bar. We're not doing loud music. We're not doing television. We want people to be able to come in and learn about what it is we're doing, but also have a good time while they're there. So
you're calling it a social club, though. Correct? Or
tasting room.
A tasting room.
Yeah, so think like a winery tasting room when you go in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We really want to redefine that tasting room in the spirits world so that people have that chance to come in and do just that. We're not looking for people to come in and get blasted. We like them to come in and try a good quality spirit, have a quality drink, and then go on about their way after they buy a bottle.
And how are people responding that you're telling about this grand experiment?
Are literally banging our door saying, when are you going to open? Wow. Will you please hurry up? It's been awesome. It's been the best community experience I've ever been a part of.
Yeah, the downtown Lansing area has really embraced us. And really, since there isn't a big brewery here or wineries here, we're hoping that the city embraces what we're doing and kind of takes ownership of it.
I can't wait to see how it takes off. Rick Weibel and Mike Bird are our guests here. They are the brains and the brawn behind American Fifth Spirits, which is taking shape in downtown Lansing. The city's first distillery is about to open on North Larch Street. Talk to us about the process of opening this distillery as far as dealing with city and state regulations.
Well, first of all, it all starts with the federal government. So I submitted the federal application back in January, I believe, same time I ordered the still. The still is being manufactured for us out of Germany, and so we're waiting for that importation to happen. And it took...
Might be a day late after the World Cup thing.
Right, yeah. They're probably still partying there. So, we're... the federal license, we received that back in May, and then we have to go through a state licensing as well. But we need to apply for that closer to the tasting room being ready to open. We're waiting on the building permits from the city in order for us to start renovating everything that we've already demolished in the building.
How many square feet?
The footprint of the building is 4,600 square feet.
Okay.
About 900 of that is going to be distillery production area. Another 1,200 is going to be whiskey storage. And then the rest is offices, bathrooms, tasting room. And then there's a whole second floor. So if everything goes according to plan, within about a year after we open, we will add a full kitchen and do full food as well. And then we will open up the second floor and do special events or other activities up there.
How big is a distiller and what does it look like?
A still?
Yeah.
Well, they range. The one we're purchasing.
The ones you're getting.
Yeah, the one we're purchasing holds about 45 to 50 gallons and stands about 10 feet tall. And so out of that, we can distill something to about 80, maybe 85% alcohol.
And what's the story behind the name? American Fifth Spirit.
All right. Yeah, that's a good question.
The fifth is a legendary, it's a legendary quantity.
It is, and it's uniquely American.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the craft spirits movement being an American phenomenon right now because of the deregulation, I guess you could say, and then the fifth being a uniquely American measurement, that's what we chose to go with.
And you hope to open your doors when?
The fifth.
Well, yeah, that was baked in the cake.
Yeah. We're going to say October. Today is October.
Yeah. October. Vodka in a few weeks. It'll be called Hugh, and gin and light whiskey to follow shortly thereafter.
As soon as we get our doors open,
okay,
it'll be available.
This is so exciting. We're glad to have had our guests here. Rick Weibel, president and head distiller of American Fifth Spirits. Mike Bird is American Fifth's marketing director. Look for them. It's taking shape on North Larch right across from Cooley Law School Stadium. Mike and Rick, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WKAR, its current state, and I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll preview tomorrow night's Major League Baseball All-Star Game taking place in Minneapolis. Last week, new regulations took effect governing how sign language interpreters are used in places like courtrooms and hospitals here in Michigan. The changes will affect not only Michigan's deaf and hard of hearing population, but interpreters as well. Here to help us learn more about what the state hopes to accomplish with the revised rules, Leslie Fritz, Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Welcome back, Leslie.
Thanks so much for having me.
The state only instituted a certification system for sign language interpreters 7 years ago. Let's start by describing the problems that the state hopes to address with the changes that went into effect here just a week ago. Can you give us an overview of what they're hoping to accomplish?
Absolutely. 7 years ago, you're right, for the first time, Michigan required certification for individuals working as sign language interpreters. Prior to that, no standards needed to be met for anybody who wanted to call themselves an interpreter. So the first step was creating the certification and professionalizing that important profession. These rules take the next step. And essentially, the rules recognize for the first time that not all communication is equal. The communication that occurs, for example, in a doctor's office between doctor and patient is different than the communication that occurs in an employee training session or in a courtroom or in a classroom.
Different lexicon.
Exactly. Yeah. Different technical terms, different terminology, different subject matter, and somebody who is well-versed and able to interpret effectively in a classroom setting for a kindergartner or a first grader may not have the technical skill to work in an emergency room. And so for the first time, these rules recognize that those communications are different and require different levels of certification and different levels of experience. They also recognize that the consequences of miscommunication in those settings can be significantly impactful to the deaf person involved.
Hospitals, courtrooms, of course. Are there examples of unfair outcomes for a deaf defendant in a courtroom, for example, who didn't get an adequately accurate interpretation?
Well, those who are deaf advocates in our state certainly believe and point to. I can't cite a specific case. But there are the advocacy community argues that deaf individuals in our courtrooms more often than not, or too often, I guess I should say, don't get a fair trial because the communication isn't necessarily effective. The other place that it can be impactful and hard to measure are individuals sitting on juries who are deaf. if they are not receiving accurate effective communication as they're listening to or participating in the trial, they may not render a correct verdict. So you've got a number of ways that justice in our state can be impacted by deaf participation in the justice system. So it works both ways, both defendant and participant.
Do you anticipate creating specialists, in other words, translators who specialize in the courtroom setting and specialize in a hospital setting, for example?
Well, the rules are not designed to force interpreters to select a particular setting, but that very well may be what occurs, in that an individual who receives the level of certification that's required to work in a courtroom, and then also the legal endorsement, which is essentially an extra certification, may choose to make their living working in the courtroom exclusively, because like any business, they, as you're hiring sign language interpreters, you get comfortable working with somebody you believe they provide effective communication. You know they're good quality. The work they do is good quality. You tend to go back to those people. And mm-hmm. so people become recognized as highly competent in a particular setting and may choose to practice exclusively in that case. It is not required under the rules. Somebody who has the certification, for example, to work in a courtroom may also choose at times to work in a hospital setting. Any other setting available to them. So exclusivity is not required, but certainly we could see that specialization being recognized and people choosing to go that route.
Leslie Fritz is our guest here on Current State. Leslie's deputy director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. We're talking about new regulations that just took effect last week governing how sign language interpreters are used in particular places here in Michigan. Are there adequate numbers of translators?
There is a shortage right now based on geography. There are parts of our state that are rural enough where there is not the sufficient level of interpreters to work, especially in some of the more specialized settings. We hear about it most regularly in education because that is a different certification that is required to work in the classroom. The interpreter has to pass what's called the EIPA. So that's the most common place we hear about it. But certainly other places outside of the classroom experience it as well. But it typically is based predominantly on geography.
Is it
more
the
than
inner city or is it rural settings?
It is northern Michigan and the UP, predominantly rural settings, where the most serious complaints come from, that there are not enough interpreters.
Mm. Are schools where interpreters are being trained, are they equipped to do the training that will be required by the new rules? Is that a concern?
Well, it's certainly a legitimate question. There are five interpreter training programs in Michigan. All of them produce good quality graduates. I can't say that I know specifically what percentage of their graduates are able to pass, take the certification test and pass it. But that's a question that we know is going to need to be examined. Are they producing enough in terms of numbers? Do they need to expand their capacity to meet demand? And like any other part of the market, if there is greater demand, we feel confident that the supply chain will expand. And are they producing individuals able to take and pass the certification tests? We have worked closely with those schools on the rule development, and they are focused on what the rules require, and we believe that they're doing a good quality job right now. The question is, do they need to expand to produce additional graduates? And that's a question that they'll have to answer based on the market demand.
What's the nearest location to us here in East Lansing where
Lansing
we're training?
Community College
LCC.
Has an ITP program. Yep, okay. And there's an interpreter training program at Lansing Community College. That's one of the five.
How are these new regulations going to be enforced? How strict will that be?
Well, that is the responsibility of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights to enforce them, and we intend to be very, very rigorous in our enforcement. The communication that we're talking about is essential for a deaf or hard of hearing person in Michigan to be able to participate fully in our state's everything the state has to offer, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in getting and maintaining housing, whether it's in enjoying a public accommodation. So we intend to be very vigorous in our enforcement of the rules. And there's two different elements to that. Obviously, bad actors we will go after and ensure that we penalize them as necessary. But more important to us is to ensure that those who are affected by the rules understand the requirements, because more often than not, what we see is not necessarily an attempt to get around them, but a misunderstanding of what the law requires when somebody requests an accommodation. And I'm talking about those folks who are needing to hire interpreters. We need to work as closely as we can with hospitals, with schools, with courtrooms, with employers, with hotels, with everybody who may be asked to provide an accommodation, to ensure they understand what the law expects of them. Because we know that the vast majority of business owners in this state, public accommodation providers in this state, want to do the right thing for their customers, for their clients, for their patients. And we want to do all that we can to help them understand what the right thing is and what the law requires.
Well, maintaining credibility in the whole process, is integrity in the whole process, has got to be really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But how strictly? I mean, are we talking fines or jail time or I mean, how?
Well, the law gives the department and the division the authority to levy fines. There's two different types of complaints that we'll investigate, and this may be more technical than you want to get into, so I'll try to keep it out of the weeds. But there's essentially two types of complaints. There's the my interpreter that I requested was not effective or not credentialed properly, essentially a poor interpreter complaint. That's not the greatest term for it. And then there's also the failure to accommodate complaint. I asked for an interpreter and the doctor's office
just didn't happen.
Refused to provide one, or decided they didn't want to hire me because I was too much hassle. That's a different level of complaint, because that falls under the federal ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, as well as the state's Persons with Disabilities Act. So that is – we already enforce those laws and we already take those types of complaints. I asked for an accommodation. It's needed because I have a disability. It was not provided. That can end up in front of our commission. They can render penalties, everything from pain and suffering to back pay, whatever the situation may be. So there's two different types of complaints that we will take and investigate that can result in different types of penalties. If the interpreter, for example, is pretending to have credentials they don't, they could be prohibited from working in that field, or their credential could be suspended. So there's a variety of different outcomes depending on the type of complaint that comes before us.
Leslie Fritz is our guest on Current State, Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. On another matter, Leslie, the Department of Civil Rights Division on Deaf and Hard of Hearing has welcomed a Michigan Public Service Commission probe into the state's telecommunication relay service for people with hearing and speech difficulties. AT&T has proposed to subcontract some of these telephone services. Can you explain the Civil Rights Department's concerns there?
Well, I can certainly explain our interest in what's happening. The TRS, the Telecommunications Relay Service, is the phone service that has been provided for years. If you are a deaf or hard of hearing individual, you pick up the phone to make a phone call, you're connected through this TRS, and essentially an interpreter aids that communication. We work with a couple of deaf employees. We use it in our own offices. The FCC at the federal level, the Federal Communications Commission, requires that states provide this service to deaf and hard of hearing individuals. Here in Michigan, it has all gone through. AT&T provides it regardless of who your phone carrier is. So even if the phone you've picked up is not an AT&T service, AT&T has provided that service, and then the phone companies send money back and forth to make sure that the costs are covered properly. And we all pay a small fee on our phone service, on our phone bill, our landline phone bill, to help cover the costs of that service. It's existed for many, many years. AT&T just recently announced, I believe in May, that they're no longer going to provide that service to anybody beyond their own customer base. So our concern, obviously, is that this service continue to be provided. It is a critical element of communication for deaf and hard of hearing persons in Michigan. So that was the PSC's interest in getting involved to ensure that we meet federal requirements and are providing the service that's required of us. But obviously, we have an interest in ensuring that service is uninterrupted for deaf and hard of hearing people in Michigan. So we encourage — the public comment period is open until August 7th. We encourage anybody who uses that service to speak up about how important it is.
While you're here, I have to let you know that I got several comments on your last visit of people who enjoyed our segment on you're marking the 50th anniversary of Michigan's Department of Civil Rights.
That was a fun topic. We could have talked about that one for a long time.
And the first in the nation.
The right? first in the nation.
50 years ago this year. Leslie Fritz has been our guest. Leslie's Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Major League Baseball's All-Star Break is here. The Midsummer Classic is set for tomorrow night in Minneapolis. WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports, and Current State's Peter Wharf got together to preview what's on tap.
But, you know, it's tough because, you know, when you look at, you know, Kinsler getting in, even though, you know, he's having the best season statistically of his entire career, I mean, it's tough to argue that, you know, a guy like Robinson Cano doesn't deserve to be in the lineup for the All-Star. So, but other than that, you know, Kinsler, even though not getting the All-Star bid, hey, he's still having a great season. He's been very consistent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking at those other guys who are All-Stars, how about Max Scherzer, who has, you know, bar none, been the best pitcher on this Detroit Tigers team.
Right.
You look at V-Mart, who leads this team in just about every statistical category when it comes to batting. And Miguel Cabrera, he's Miguel Cabrera, one of the best we've ever seen.
Keeps on trucking. And Kinsler, he's been an All-Star before, so that has to factor in a little bit.
Exactly, it does. You know, the competitiveness, when you see Ian Kinsler out there, you know, playing specifically this year with the Tigers, I mean, he's a very competitive guy. He goes out there and he's trying to win. He's trying to get that bat on the ball each and every time he approaches the plate. He's so competitive, but like you said, he's been an All-Star before. Mm-hmm. He would have loved to have been an All-Star this year. I mean, who wouldn't, right? I mean, it's an All-Star. It's a great weekend. But at the same time, this allows him to also get in some rest and kind of get mentally focused for the second part of the season. You all know the baseball season, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, Peter. And for him to relax, get some time off, and for this whole team really to relax and sort of evaluate that first half is good for the whole team.
Right. And the Tigers are very well represented. It's not like the Tigers are snubbed in any way. You could argue perhaps Kinsler, but the Tigers have their stars both at the plate and on the mound.
Exactly. Without a doubt. You know, you got a guy like, again, Max Scherzer, who many believe to be, you know, one of the best, if not the best, in many people's estimations, you know, in the game. You got Miguel Cabrera, who many consider to be, you know, one of the best batters, if not the best batters in the game. And you got a guy like V-Mart, who is really, it's an interesting dynamic with V-Mart, because a lot of people were nervous when Prince left his team last year, because Prince was the guy, the regular season, let me clarify, during the regular season, who could come in and be that guy that was really the yin to the yang, the Batman to Robin to Miguel Cabrera.
And the guy from the left side of the plate.
Exactly, from the left side of the plate. So now, you know, when Prince left, it was like, okay, well, we'll see if V-Mart can fill that void. And he has done that times 20, Peter. He has really turned a lot of heads, including mine.
Right. Well, for purposes of this discussion, we are talking about individuals. It is, after all, about All-Stars, individual performance, recognition of the star players. But let's go through a few more of the team elements of the Detroit Tigers halfway through the season and throw some grades down. Let's see how we compare to each other.
Yeah.
You want to start off with team offense, batting?
Yeah, as far as batting goes, Peter, I would give this team a B plus, and you have grades too. It's going to be interesting to see how this compares.
Yes,
I'm going to go B plus with the Tigers for offense and batting, simply because of this. I think they've gotten timely hitting when they needed it throughout most of this season. Relatively consistent to a degree from their stars. Their stars have been relatively consistent, but for them to jump to an A plus for me, Peter, the rest of that order has to get consistent. We've seen struggles with Brad Ausmus in trying to find specifically a guy like Austin Jackson, you know, who he played around with either making him a leadoff guy or keeping him down in that 5 and 6 order. We've seen Alex Avila and Nick Castellanos kind of struggle on where they should be and their consistency as well. Right now, the Tigers are 5th in the league in batting. Yeah. V-Mart, Miguel Cabrera, Ian Kinsler, all three of those guys are in the top 20 in hitting. V-Mart is 4th in the league in home runs. Right. Miguel Cabrera, 2nd in the entire league in RBIs. I mean, that alone right there, that's pretty solid. Pretty solid that, you know, those stats right there are really eye-popping. You know, consistency, though, you know, because the bats have gone cold, Peter. Right. There's been moments, especially throughout that 9 and 20 stretch.
That's right.
Exactly. Throughout that 9 and 20 stretch where the Tigers, they couldn't give any type of pitcher any type of support.
Right.
So that's why I won't bump them up to an A plus. What did you have? I'm curious.
Al, we were so close. I went A minus to your B plus.
Okay.
As you said, the Tigers are fifth in the league in run production. They've scored a ton of runs.
Exactly.
And although as the Detroit Tigers, historically, I want to see a little more power.
Exactly.
I'd like to see a little more consistent power. So
right.
That's why I didn't give them the full A. I was close to you. I was at A minus. Okay. Yep. Offense. How about defense for you?
Yeah, defense is that, you know, that's been, and which we'll get to later on in the discussion, the relief pitching. Defense and relief pitching has been the Achilles heel for this Tigers team, Peter. You got to have defense and relief pitching if the Tigers are going to get over that hump and finally win a World Series. But I give the defense a D. I'm a pretty harsh guy.
Wow.
I'm going all the way to D.
Yes,
a D, Peter. Yeah. And the Tigers right now, the reason why I'm giving them a D, they're right now 19th in the entire major league when it comes to defense and fielding. And, you know, in May, if you look at it, this is an interesting stat I was looking up, Peter. Mm-hmm. In May, the Tigers had converted 71% of their ground balls into outs. Mm. Now, opponents against, you know, two of arguably the best pitchers on this team right now, and Rick Porcello, who was really close to making an All-Star team, and, of course, Max Scherzer, opponents had a .326 batting average on balls in play against Porcello, and a .403 percentage against Scherzer. Now, the AL average, looking at those, again, that's .326 and .403 against Max Scherzer and Rick Porcello. The AL average, Peter, is .284. Can you believe that? And Porcello, we know that Porcello is a ground ball pitcher. I mean, he figures to be more affected by that stat than Scherzer, and Scherzer's numbers are higher. Can you believe that? I couldn't believe that.
That's amazing. Al, I thought I was being harsh at a B minus. I mean, the Tigers are certainly no St. Louis or no Seattle in terms of team defense,
right?
But they're far from a disastrous Cleveland Indians.
Exactly.
They're somewhere in the middle. What did you say? In the teens somewhere. So,
right.
So
right.
I went B minus. Maybe I'm being a little generous, but
I'm a harsh guy too. Let's put that in perspective.
You are.
Too.
You're an extreme man, and that's why I love you.
Right.
But you know, I like to look up the middle. I'm a traditionalist.
Right.
I'm old school, so I'm always looking up the middle, catcher, second base, shortstop, center field.
Right.
And you're looking pretty good at second base, of course, with Kinsler.
Exactly.
Center field with Austin Jackson, Suarez at shortstop, you know, kind of. Okay.
Yeah,
average.
Okay. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, during, you know, I talked about Austin Jackson's struggles throughout this season. Brad Ausmus, Tigers manager, struggling to find where exactly does Austin Jackson fit the best in this lineup. And the thing was, I mean, you know, Brad Ausmus, he kind of foiled around with the idea of benching Austin Jackson. But if you look at this Tigers roster, and Brad brought up an interesting point with this, the Tigers, when you look at that center field position, Austin Jackson is really the only true center fielder
on that
Tigers
roster. You've
got to
put your fastest man in center field.
Exactly.
That's it.
Right, exactly. And that's why, you know, Brad is so kind of, you know, hesitant on pulling the trigger and just completely benching him because he wants him out there.
Unless you have absolute hands of stone, you're an Austin Jackson, you play center field.
Exactly. I agree. I totally agree.
Okay, so a D from you, a B minus from me. Let's talk about starting pitching. I'm really interested to see what you say here because there might be an obvious choice, but maybe not.
Exactly. Well, you know, I went with a C because right now the Tigers, as far as starting pitching goes, they're right now, they're ranked 24th in the league, Peter. 24th. And, you know, that number really is eye-popping because you got arguably, you know, two of the best pitchers that we've seen in quite some time. Max Scherzer brings it every time he's on the mound. JV is a guy who I had never seen a pitcher like him in my lifetime. During his heyday a few years back, I mean, he's unbelievable. But now, you know, JV, it's been a roller coaster type of a season, to say the least, as far as his output is concerned. He's had games where he's looked pretty good. He's had games where he's looked horrible. We saw not too long ago where he goes out, you know, in the first inning and gives up, you know, five runs. Then we see him settle down and only give up one hit the rest of the game. So he's been really up and down. Right now, this Tigers team has a combined ERA of over 4.
Right.
Anibal Sanchez, he has an ERA of over 3. Porcello and Scherzer, though, they are second in the AL in wins.
Yeah, Al, I said very reluctant B for the starting pitching.
Yeah.
Only because we talked about the run production, basically scoring five runs to giving up four runs is what's putting the Tigers up on top where they are. I think if one starting pitcher has an injury or some sort of problem in the second half of the season,
Right,
you could see big trouble.
You definitely could. And right now, it always comes in baseball more so than any other sport. That C word, consistency, is so big.
Okay, well, we'll save the best for last. Relief pitching.
Oh boy, you know that is. I always rant about the relief pitching. I feel like each and every time I talk about the Tigers on Current Sports, Peter. Right now, I'm going with D on the relief pitching, and you know the Tigers are 16th in the league in relief pitching. It's been their Achilles heel. It's been I won't put it all on relief pitching, but it's been a big, big component to why the Tigers haven't won a World Series in quite some time. And they just haven't gotten over that hill. And you look right now, Joe Nathan is 16th in the league. Jabba Chamberlain is dead last in the league right now as far as relief pitching is concerned. The Tigers really have to rely on their starting pitching and batting so much. Because a league could disappear and vanish in the blink of an eye. We've seen that multiple occasions throughout this season,
Peter.
We've
talked about how just get to the bullpen and you can beat the Tigers.
Exactly. And that's why teams, they feel as though no matter how much they're down in a game, they still have faith. If that eighth or ninth inning comes, they have faith that they can rally the troops just because they know these guys haven't been outstanding. I mean, Jabba Chamberlain last in the league, Peter? That's crazy to me.
Well, let's not end on a downer, Al. Let's look ahead. Let's move forward.
Right, let's stay positive.
What do you think about the second half? What are you looking forward to the second half of the season?
I think that in the second half of the season, you're going to see a renewed focus on this team. I think that looking at a guy like Justin Verlander, especially when you talk about that starting pitching, honing in on a guy like Justin Verlander for a sec. Justin is a guy who we've seen how good he is, how good he can be. And we've joked, and you've heard this on Current Sports, we've joked that maybe, you know, his focus isn't there. You know, maybe dating Cade Upton is attributed to that. We, you know, we've joked about that. But I think that you're going to see a renewed focus on this team. I think you're going to see guys like a guy like Austin Jackson, you know, guys like Nick Castellanos and Alex Avila start to find their stride as the season goes on. I'm just still worried, though. I'm still worried about that relief pitching, though, Peter. All in all, I think the Tigers do make a deep run, and I think they do make a move to try and beef up that bullpen.
Al Martin is host of AM 870's Current Sports and Current Sports on WKAR-TV. Thanks, Al.
Thank you, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll discuss the proposed natural gas pipeline in Michigan and what that means for the economy and the environment. And we'll learn how to turn your hunting and fishing haul into a gourmet meal. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Marie Steinbach for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.